Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's a national holiday, Friday, November 11th, 2016. It's Veterans Day. And I want to honor all the veterans who listen to this podcast. I'm grateful for your service. And I am sorry for those of you who were sent into missions of folly, which is the recent history of American overseas military action. And I saw one post on Facebook from a veteran who is quite dejected at the change in direction that the country he fought for has taken. Greg Pallast is the investigative reporter who released an important film before this year's election. And in that film, he predicted that the election would be rigged in favor of the Republican candidate. And in a follow-up interview today that I'm releasing to all of my subscribers at peterbcollins.com and our other outlets, Greg Pallast flatly says, this election was stolen, pure and simple. He says it was rigged by a sequence of schemes embraced by Republicans, including the 30 states who participated in the murky interstate cross-check list, and that was a central focus of Pallast's most recent film and book, and there's a cartoon version of the book as well. It's called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. And here's an excerpt from my conversation with Greg Pallast today.
Well, and my film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, is about how Trump's going to steal the election, and the GOP will steal the Senate, too. And I thought it looked like history was going to make a fool of me, and that I had hung out there on celluloid making an improbable statement. Well, unfortunately, history has patted me on the back too in a very frightening way.
Yeah,
this election was stolen, pure and simple. It was rigged, and the reason why Trump said it is that because he knew his buddies were rigging it. And through several tricks that I uncover in the film and in the companion book, the GOP had a secret list of 7.2 million voters that it intended to pull off the voter rolls. They didn't get all of them. They didn't expect to. But they did get about 1.1 million people chucked off the voter rolls for the crime of voting twice or registering twice in two different states. So Peter B. Collins registered in state in California and then registered, say, in Alabama, which is against the law, unless you've moved. But if you're intending to vote, that's a felony crime. 5 years in the slammer. So they removed 1.1 million voters, and as far as I could tell, in terms of this crime, they arrested four people for doing this. And it doesn't look like they came even off this list.
You can hear the full interview with Greg Pallast. It's released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spreaker, every place where we distribute the Peter B. Collins podcast, except for YouTube. YouTube is only the outlet for our daily news and comment podcast. So if that's where you're listening, come on over to peterbcollins.com and you can find the Pallast interview. In addition to the interstate cross-checklist, we also talk about the long lines at polling places by design in states like Ohio, where I witnessed it myself this past Sunday. And the other tactics that were used to somehow keep Democratic voters from participating. And North Carolina is one of the key states. We call it the laboratory of voter suppression. And it's interesting to see that despite all of those efforts and the handy reelection of Senator Richard Burr, who is a far-right guy who is now chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, that the embattled governor, the Republican Pat McCrory, who used to run a utility before he was recruited by the right wing to run the state of North Carolina, he presided over all of these voter suppression tactics that were enacted over the last few years. And it appears that Roy Cooper, his Democratic opponent, is clinging to a narrow lead of less than 5,000 votes at this hour. And, of course, one of the contentious issues is HB 2, House Bill 2, the one that, tried to regulate bathrooms and prevent transgender individuals from using the bathroom of the gender that they identify with. And this, of course, led to a lot of criticism of North Carolina, cancellation of big events like the NBA All-Star Game, and the, it seems to be catching up with Pat McCrory. We don't know if this number will stand, and, of course, because Republicans run the election system in North Carolina, we can't count on an honest outcome. Now, one of the ways that we look for fraudulent outcomes, election fraud, not voter fraud, election fraud. That's where the people running the election jigger the results. And in talking with Greg Pallast, he affirmed the work of the statisticians, Jonathan Simon, who I quoted yesterday, and an additional source, a man named Theodore D. Macedo Suarez, who has done an exit poll analysis and comes up with similar findings as Jonathan Simon. And those findings are that there is a measurable shift between the exit polls and the official results as announced by the election officials. And in North Carolina, it amounts to almost 6%, Pennsylvania, 5.6%, Wisconsin, 4.9%. And you get the pattern, because these are states where, in Michigan, the margin there in Michigan, I don't have that at my fingertips here, but Michigan is still an open case where the election has not been called, because the difference between the two candidates is about 12,000 votes. And when you look at how voter suppression could work in an election this close, well, Greg Pallast's conclusion that this election was stolen pure and simple, I think, holds up to close scrutiny. Meanwhile, there is reaction in the streets of the United States, and last night, Portland, Oregon was the hot spot. Thousands of protesters, about 4,000 people, hit the streets as darkness descended around 5 p.m. And Jason Leopold, our friend and colleague from Vice News, was in Portland. I'm not sure why, but he captured video and filed a report that I'm linking to in the show file for this podcast. And the crowd was around the downtown Pioneer Courthouse Square, chanting, "Whose streets? Our streets. Fuck Donald Trump." Others held signs saying, "Love Trump's hate" and "Fuck Trump." But one of the troubling issues is that it did become violent, and some of the handful of violent protesters smashed car windows at a Toyota dealership, spray-painted "Kill Trump" on newspaper boxes, and in one case that Jason Leopold did capture on video, at about 10:30 last night, a Jeep that was driving past Pioneer Courthouse Square, flying a Trump banner and an American flag, was spotted by the protesters. They began chasing it, and a woman confronted the male driver, asked why he was supporting Trump, and then they smashed a headlight on the Jeep. Another person attempted to smash the windshield as the passengers of the car filmed it, and the driver tried to leave. Now, the driver was, he was able to break away from that group, and a block later, he was confronted by hundreds more people, and a protester threw a smoke bomb inside the vehicle and then spray-painted "Fuck Trump" on the passenger door of the vehicle. And this is not helpful, but it is understandable. This kind of anger is very real. And it's not just white people in the Midwest who are angry in this country. Now, I don't condone violence of any form, whether it is committed by liberals or conservatives, Trump supporters or others. But it's a separate issue as to what drives the anger that we're seeing expressed. Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, following up on an item we covered here yesterday in the News and Comment podcast, rejects the notion that fake news on Facebook influence the outcome of this election. He said that's a pretty crazy idea. Voters make decisions based on their lived experience, he said at the Technonomy conference near San Francisco yesterday. He continued, "There is a profound lack of empathy in asserting that the only reason someone could have voted the way they did is because they saw fake news." Now, I don't think that's the allegation that was made here. Voters' intentions and decisions really are cumulative based on the information that they see over a period of time. And if all you see is news that comes from like-minded friends and approved news sources that fit your worldview, and if that includes absolutely fake, concocted information that is presented as news, well, I think that can affect the outcome. Zuck went on to say that people's news feeds are becoming increasingly personalized to the point that opposing views are no longer visible. He rejects that idea. "We've studied it a lot. I really care about this," he said, adding that in order to have a good impact on the world, he wants people to have diversity of information. And he compared the current media landscape to 20 years ago, when people only had access to three major TV networks and some newspapers. You got all your news filtered through that. Yes, but that information was vetted, mediated, curated, edited, and most importantly, the professional reputations of the people who presented that news generally kept them from putting fake news into what was honestly filtered and centralized information distribution. With Facebook, Zuck said, most users have friends who have different political views. Even if 90% of your friends are Democrats, probably 10% are Republicans. Even if you live in some state or country, you will know some people in another state, another country. That means that the information you're getting through the social system is going to be inherently more diverse than you would have gotten through news stations. That's not true. Comparing the old days, we had networks that, there was no Fox News pretending to be fair and balanced while presenting information that clearly is not. So I think that Zuckerberg, it's understandable how he defends his company and the whole Facebook system. But I would like to see him take a deeper look at this and maybe reflect in a self-critical way a little more deeply. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. And I want to take a moment to thank one supporter who's been with me for many years, Bob Donjacour, here in San Francisco. I mentioned about a month ago that Bob was in a very serious bicycle accident. And it's ironic because Bob had just completed the week before a bike ride from San Francisco to Colorado. Then he took the train back. And he was riding in his neighborhood in San Francisco when he was struck by a hit-and-run driver. He remains in very serious condition. He's been moved to a long-term care facility. He has not regained consciousness. The coma may be the best thing for him to help his body repair itself, but it is deeply concerning. And if you pray, I ask you to offer prayers. I'm not a prayer guy, but I have had Bob Donjacour on my mind and in my thoughts for much of the past month, and I hope that you will offer your good thoughts and vibrations, however you express that, for our friend and supporter, Bob Donjacour. And let me thank Amy Annette, Hillary Hamilton, and Perry Productions. They all have renewed their annual subscriptions in the last couple of weeks, and I'm very grateful for your support. As I've mentioned, this contentious political cycle has cost me subscribers and listeners, and I encourage you to step up if you're able. I don't want your Social Security money or the rent money, but if you've got extra cash and you'd like to show that you value the work I do here, come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, pull down, click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and in just a couple of minutes, you can pick the level of support you're comfortable with and sign up for a subscription. A bit of a surprise, but then again, I expect a lot of daily surprises from Donald Trump. He's a guy who is quick to fire people. And that's not just the act that we saw on The Apprentice. And let me confess, I never watched a whole episode of The Apprentice. I couldn't stomach it. But he is a quick-tempered guy. He is easily offended. He demands high loyalty, and any lack of that can lead Trump to lash out at people. And yesterday, the victim was Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, who had hoped, he ran against Trump in the primaries. He was one of the early opponents to endorse Trump. He was rewarded by being named head of the transition team. And yesterday, without much warning, Donald Trump sacked Chris Christie from his role directing the transition effort, and he replaced him with Mike Pence, the vice president-elect. Now, Mike Pence is wired to Washington and the Republican establishment in ways that Chris Christie is not. And Mike Pence is a formidable figure to deal with. He is deeply conservative. He's part of the far-right religious right. He is deeply anti-abortion. He's against Planned Parenthood. Was one of the first governors to defund them. He is a neocon and major apologist for Bush's war in Iraq. And he has a muscular idea of how our foreign policy should be conducted. So in many ways, I don't see this as a good thing for those of us who oppose what Trump stands for. But it is interesting that as two of Christie's top aides or former aides were convicted last week in the Bridgegate scandal back in 2013, that Christie is paying a price. Now, this could mean that Christie's being groomed for some other position. I imagine Trump will want to appoint him to a post if he does anything with Christie that doesn't require Senate confirmation, because even with Republicans in control of the Senate, that could be a very contentious process. So it is, I think, a signal here that Christie is going to go through people Trump is going to go through people very quickly. And what I think the net effect will be is that the bullies who are out there trying to protect the interests of Donald Trump and keep people in line will be very effective, and that people will be resigning and fired on almost a daily basis. So get used to that. Now, in addition, Trump has appointed Rick Dearborn, who is chief of staff to Senator Jeff Sessions, the knuckle-dragger from Alabama. And Sessions is a very dangerous right-wing figure who has extra influence on Donald Trump, because he was about the only member of the Senate who actually endorsed Trump, and he did so earlier. And Christie's assistant or associate, Rich Bagger, has been pushed out of the transition team. Meanwhile, the New York Times is speculating about who's going to surface with big jobs. But the transition team has added 12 new people, including a major donor, Rebecca Mercer, Steve Bannon, the Breitbart guy, the alt-right media fellow, Reince Priebus, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, Peter Thiel, the co-founder of PayPal and the gay Silicon Valley billionaire, who was one of the few here on the West Coast to support Trump, Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, and the Trump gang, Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, and his three adult children. Now, what are those people doing on the transition team? They don't know anything about politics. They've never participated. And this family circle is troubling, because Trump says that he's going to step down as the head of his Trump organization and the many companies that he controls and put his kids in charge. But if the kids are also involved in the administration, then we have these ongoing and very serious conflicts of interest. And I would say that even handing the businesses off to the kids doesn't achieve any real arm's length arrangement that reduces the appearance of a conflict of interest. So, we don't have any control over this. We can just kind of watch and comment and harumph. But it is disturbing to see the Trump family populate the early stages of the administration. And I hope you're not consuming food right now, but the rumors of who will be the chief of staff in the Trump White House include the aforementioned propagandist Steve Bannon and Reince Priebus, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, who is a pretty useless guy, and was the object of Trump's ire for much of the campaign. But in victory, well, that's how things roll out. There was a very contentious meeting of the Democratic National Committee yesterday, and Donna Brazile, the interim leader who replaced Debbie Wasserman Schultz when she ran into the buzzsaw over the Bernie Sanders tip last summer, well, she took quite a bit of heat from a staff member who is identified only as Zach. Zach stood up in the middle of Donna Brazile's talk and said, "Why should we trust you as chair to lead us through this? You backed a flawed candidate, and your friend Debbie Wasserman Schultz plotted through this to support your own gain and yourself." He went on, "You are part of the problem. You and your friends will die of old age, and I'm going to die from climate change. You and your friends let this happen, which is going to cut 40 years off my life expectancy." Zach then gathered his things and began to walk out. Brazile called after him, and he turned around and said, "Well, go outside and tell people there why you, Donna Brazile, should be leading the party." So I think that this kind of conflict is healthy. I think that Zach's comments are accurate if understated, and I'm glad to see Donna Brazile get the comeuppance she so richly deserves. Another insider apologist for the Democratic loss is David Plouffe, who published an op-ed in the New York Times today called "What I Got Wrong About the Election." And this is the guy who was the chief strategist for Obama in 2008 and also worked on the re-election in 2012. He said, "So all of the forecasts that got it wrong, my prediction that Mrs. Clinton was a 100% favorite was a glaring miss." He said, "My confidence was not partisan spin." Well, it is amazing to me, and lots of people are messaging me, sending emails and other Facebook comments, noting that I did predict that Donald Trump could win, and that Democrats were in deep denial and hopelessly in a bubble about Hillary Clinton's popularity and prospects for victory. But it is hard to hear these people claim that they weren't victims of partisan spin. I think the Democratic spin machine was very effective. David Brock was pumping out the lies on a daily basis. He had the internet trolls to try to enforce, a retribution to people who criticized the Clinton candidate. So it's fascinating to see how the Democratic leadership looks at this. Now, Plouffe correctly points out that Democratic turnout was down this year, not only in the primaries, despite the Bernie Sanders effort, but also in the general. In Detroit, Clinton received 70,000 votes fewer than Obama in 2012, and she lost Michigan by only 12,000 votes. That's still undecided, but that's the consensus. In Milwaukee County, she received 40,000 fewer votes than Obama did and lost the state by only 27,000. In Cuyahoga County, where Cleveland is, turnout in majority African-American precincts was down 11% from 4 years ago. And in one bullet point, he says, "It really was a change election, and there was only one change candidate." And that, of course, is the big blunder. The arrogance of the Democratic leadership and the superdelegates who hung in with Hillary Clinton after it was very clear that she was badly damaged by some of her own actions, the emails, the Clinton Foundation, and other obvious flaws. And yet they hung in there believing that running a not-Trump campaign, that anybody with a pulse should be able to win. And that was the huge miscalculation. He also writes, "Strong and weak currents beat data and analytics." And he's talking about some of the mechanics of election. He said, "It appears that there really were hidden Trump voters," meaning that his ceiling of support was higher than most of us believed possible. "And millions of potential Clinton voters who the models suggested would vote actually stayed home. But this doesn't take into account the very serious voter suppression tactics that we opened our podcast with and the commentary from investigative reporter Craig Pallast. Now, one of the false notions, in my view, that was advanced by the Clinton campaign, embraced by the Obama administration, is that Russia was meddling in our elections. And without any proof, we've been told that Russia was responsible for the hacks of the DNC and the John Podesta emails. And I have said that I would eat some rubles or maybe some borscht if facts surface that conflict with that. Well, here is some information that does conflict a little with my point of view. Yesterday, the Deputy Foreign Minister of Russia, Sergei Ryabkov, we'll call him Sergei, he said that there were contacts between the Russian government and advisors to the Donald Trump campaign. He says, "We continue to do this and have been doing this work during the election campaign. I cannot say that all, but a wide range of them," that's Trump advisors, "were in touch with Russian representatives." Now, this appears pretty damning. And Rachel Maddow on MSDNC last night went with this hook, line, and sinker. Now, it is troubling to hear that there were these contacts with the Trump campaign from the Russian government. But this does not substantiate in any way, the claims that have been made that Russia is responsible for the hacks and that Russia fed WikiLeaks the information hacked from the DNC and John Podesta's email account. But that is the strong impression that Rachel Maddow left her viewers in a 20-minute diatribe where she repeated the same crap over and over again. It's so frustrating the way she operates. And in the end, she was questioning whether Donald Trump should be allowed to receive the classified briefings, the presidential daily brief, that he is entitled to as the president-elect. Now, that's suggesting that he would feed classified information to the Russians. And even I think that that is something that is a very serious charge that one shouldn't make without evidence. And Rachel Maddow offered zero evidence to that effect. In a full-page ad in today's New York Times, the head of the American Civil Liberties Union, Anthony Romero, talks to President Trump, and he says that the president-elect should reconsider and change course on certain campaign promises that he made, like the development of a deportation force to remove 11 million undocumented immigrants, the ban of entry for Muslims, and to institute aggressive surveillance programs targeting them. Romero is too polite to mention that we already have aggressive surveillance programs aimed at Muslims in this country. Also, abortion rights, torture, and changing our nation's libel laws to restrict freedom of expression. And Romero writes, "These proposals are not simply un-American and wrong-headed, they are unlawful and unconstitutional." And he threatens, "If you do not reverse course and endeavor to make these campaign promises a reality, you will have to contend with the full firepower of the ACLU at your every step." Well, here's the ACLU in action. You may remember, after Ed Snowden revealed the metadata collection of the phone records of millions of innocent Americans, and the leader of the NSA and the director of national intelligence were asked to justify this, and they said, oh, there are more than 50 cases where metadata has led us to bust up terrorism plots. Then when you picked away at it, you chipped away at it, what we found is, well, they had one case, and it was an obscure case in San Diego where a group of Somali immigrants raised a few dollars, like less than $7,000, and tried to send it to the terrorist group in Somalia called Al-Shabaab. And it was the metadata that was collected on these men that led to more serious surveillance, and that was used to win convictions. And so the ACLU is weighing in and saying that this evidence was obtained illegally. And the wiretaps were based on the illegally collected metadata. And the ACLU argues that if the judge rules in favor of these defendants, it would serve as a deterrence against the government starting up similar surveillance in the future. Well, I'm glad to see this, and I hope that the ACLU does prevail in that case. Meanwhile, Spencer Ackerman in The Guardian is reporting that privacy activists and others are very concerned over Donald Trump getting access to our surveillance network and the information that it coughs up. And back on the campaign trail, Trump had made a comment about wishing he had access to surveillance powers. Referring to the hack of the DNC, he said, "I wish I had that power. Man, that would be power." And so Ben Wisner, who is one of Ed Snowden's lawyers at the ACLU, said, "I think many Americans are waking up to the fact we have created a presidency that is too powerful." And Tom Drake, one of the NSA whistleblowers I have deep respect for, said the electronic infrastructure is fully in place and ex post facto legalized by Congress and executive orders and ripe for further abuse under an autocratic, power-obsessed president. History is just not kind here. Trump leans quite autocratic. The temptations to use secret NSA surveillance powers, some still not fully revealed, will present themselves to him as sirens. In Hong Kong, some activists who have gotten elected to the local governing body have been brushed back by the leadership in Beijing. Now, 10 members of the Hong Kong Legislative Council are at risk of losing their seats because they didn't properly take their oaths of office. And this was triggered when two activist protesters took their oaths in ways that were embarrassing to the Beijing government. One of them took over 10 minutes to read her oath, pausing after each word. Nathan Law gave a preamble saying that he couldn't be loyal to a government that murders its own people. And Lung Kwok Hung, also known as Long Hair, unfurled a yellow umbrella, a symbol of the 2014 protest, when he gave his oath. So I applaud these activists, and I deplore what Beijing is doing. And finally today, we bid farewell to a great singer, a talented songwriter, a poet, and a novelist, Canadian Leonard Cohen. He had a deep baritone, a beautiful voice, and he used it very effectively. He also wrote some deep and haunting songs with heavy political undertones. And because I distribute on YouTube, they won't let me play a song in the podcast that I don't have the music license for. So I am linking to one of my favorite Leonard Cohen songs called Everybody Knows. It's in the show file for the podcast today at peterbcollins.com. Leonard Cohen, happy trails to you. Thanks for joining me for this news and comment podcast. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.